Hello, listeners. I'm Jamia.
I'm Jamila, and we are Live Voices.
Here from librarians of color, what speaks to the fullness of their careers, including successes and challenges. How do they do it? Join us to find out more about their Live Voices. Welcome to Season 5, Episode 2. Today we have an interview with Denise Solis.
Denise Solis is the Digital Collections Librarian at the University of Denver, DU. Prior to this position, she was DU's first residency librarian. She began her career in her alma mater of Florida International University as a cataloger and has since occupied both public and technical positions within academic libraries. Born and raised in Miami, Florida, her research is deeply personal and driven by a desire to affect change. She refers to her work as MeSearch, as it revolves around seeking answers to critical questions related to representation, equity, inclusion, and organizational culture.
What drew you to librarianship?
Fate. For a long time, So I'm a Virgo, and every time I did one of those like quizzes about, you know, what you want to be in the future. And like, I feel like everyone on your podcast has said this, but it was like, oh, librarian or editor or writer or like those kinds of fields. And for a long time, I tried to like avoid it because I also didn't know what a librarian, I didn't know that librarianship was an actual field until I worked in a library. Like I really loved stories. And so my major was in history and art history. That's what I got my bachelor's degree in. And then I worked at a call center, and my friend Donetta at the time, who knew how miserable I was, because if you've ever worked at a call center, you know the deep misery of what it's like to work at a call center. And I worked for Florida Power and Light, which is like the worst. So when someone's power's out, they are, you know, obviously like it's an emergency service, and we have a lot of hurricanes in Florida. And anyway, it just was this thing where she was like, Denise, you need to get out of here and have a job that doesn't stress you out so much, which in retrospect is kind of funny. She was like, hey, apply for this job it's a cataloger at FIU at Florida International University, which is where I graduated from. And so I applied, and luckily I got the job. And actually during my job interview, they said, are you interested in applying and getting your master's in library and information science? And I didn't even know that was a degree you could get. And I was like, hell yes. You mean I can have a job where I can follow the rules and enforce the rules and like just, and this is my job? Like I was just kind of like my Virgo-ness and my personality. I was like, this is such a great fit. I would love to do this. Yes. And so I started, you know, I'm my catalogerness. I learned AACR2 and RDA, which is just cataloging rules. And I really thrived in that position because I knew exactly what I was doing. Like, I love that feeling of like, you know what you're supposed to do and you're doing it really well and excelling at this thing. But of course, no one's ever satisfied with just like doing the thing. And so my mentor, who's at the time was a principal monographic cataloger and had been at FAU for like 30 years and was going to retire, she's like, Denise, I need someone to take my place. When are you going to library school? And she's this tiny Puerto Rican. Mirta Hernandez is a tiny Puerto Rican woman who, even though she's probably shorter than me, her presence and her aura is so much bigger. You know, that person that just kind of like feels so much bigger in a good way too. But she really pushed me to go to library school. And I did. And I, at the time, couldn't go. This is much longer than I intended it to be. But because I had a lot of family things happening at the time, I couldn't go to library school. Like I had to do it online. And I, at the same time, wanted a different perspective than other schools in Florida. I wanted to expand my knowledge in ways that, you know, maybe were challenged. And so I did an online program at Kent State University. I didn't realize until everyone, you know, in class did those bios, how white the field was, because I am from Miami, like, and all the people who worked at FIU were Latinos. We were the majority, you know. I come from a majority minority city. And so being kind of in those classes was just really weird. And I'll probably talk about this later, but yeah, needless to say, it was kind of a shock how other libraries were. But honestly, that got me hooked on so many things. I became the squeaky wheel. I became just that person who was always like, but why are you doing that that way? Or like, why? But why? I just had so many questions. And I think it just eventually evolved to me having so many different positions in the libraries, because although I loved cataloging, I felt like there was so much more change needed. And it got to a point where I even saw myself as wanting to become a dean one day. And I still kind of want to do that, but we'll see where life takes me. But yeah, in a roundabout way, what drew me to librarianship was almost a little bit of fate and a little bit of luck, I guess. Hopefully that answers the question. I'm sorry, I kind of went around that about in a long way.
No,
that's the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think so many librarians, the journey is circuitous, just like yours. I think that there's a lot of similarity when it comes to that and the librarian origin story. And so what you said, I think, kind of resonates a lot with me personally. But then also when I'm thinking about, you know, all the librarians and information professionals that we've interviewed, and so many of them have come to it in this like other from these other directions. And like you said before, it's just like kind of how many of us are thinking about writing or editing or, you know, like these other
law,
right? All these other areas, you know, before coming to it, but like adjacent or related in some kind of way. I think that's an interesting thing.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think some of us would have had a straighter path if, like you mentioned, if we saw someone that looked mm-hmm. like us in this profession, or even considered it being a profession. Like, who knew? We know the spaces that exist, but it never dawned on me. Like, oh yeah, I could be that. You know, so yeah, we guess we gotta do a better job.
You know, yeah, definitely, right. That's really the lesson when it comes to that. On that note, as a BIPOC librarian, what do you view as critical to the success of the field?
Like what Jamia just said. I mean, part of that is, right, like that marketing. And it's hard because it's like, what do I feel like is critical to the success of like me in the field versus just the field in general? I do feel like librarianship does not do a good job at marketing itself. We don't really... Well, I mean, because there's so many different issues, it's such a hard question to answer because it's a bunch of multiple issues. We are not paid enough for our degrees. We are very white. We are right. Vocational awe is a concept that Fobazi, and it's so true. I mean, I think especially coming from a place where my library was so diverse, there were so many different people. Latinas, like everybody was just like, I felt like I come from a library in the future, because I feel like a lot of my colleagues, they talk about, you know, I'd love to see like a BIPOC library. And I'm like, I came from that. I came from where I spoke to my colleagues in Spanish and English and whatever other language there other people could speak. And it's really hard to like, Now I'm in a library that's in almost entirely white, except for like three of us, in terms of library faculty anyway. And it's demoralizing, to be honest. And it really, I still question every day, like what keeps me in the profession, because there are other jobs, especially now. I'm not going to say post-pandemic, but like post-quarantine anyway, where there are a lot of remote positions, and a lot of that is in the information sector. And so a lot of librarians can get jobs, not in libraries, but in library adjacent fields, and they can work remotely. And for especially BIPOC, I feel like that is a win, because oftentimes, at least in my, I'm only speaking for myself, but like coming into the library can be extremely harmful and toxic and really impacts your, not just your mental health, but your physical, your emotional health. And so to try and recruit, which, because again, one of the biggest issues is recruitment, right, of BIPOC professionals in librarianship. How can you do that when they're coming into spaces that are just not made for them? And not just that, but they're coming into spaces where white folks are often unreflective of their own positionality. Like, they don't really realize how their behaviors, how their actions impact others, not just people of color, but like other people. And that's something that I've kind of become really interested in. But it's kind of these overlapping issues, right? Recruitment, the whiteness of the field, the lack of equitable pay, the lack of pay, the lack of marketing of this profession. People don't know that librarianship is a thing. And then to top it off, you have to get a master's degree, which I know that's like a whole other debate, but it's just, it's, there's so many compounding things that I'm so sorry. I feel like this is a question that is incredibly hard to answer because there are so many different things that are critical to the success of the field.
And this is why we ask it.
It's a good question.
It is a lot of layered things there to consider, and yeah, and what, like you said, what is successful for you might not be successful for the field at large or for someone else. So what does that look like? And so yeah, great response to the question. That's a difficult question for sure.
But you shared with us, I think, a lot of the things that we're all thinking about when this question is asked. And those are all issues that we're working towards trying to fix, or trying to find some kind of way. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we do have to address and tackle. There's librarianship is not perfect in like so many other career fields, you know, so it's not just us having to do these things, right, and having to work towards this. And, people of color across the board are having these same kinds of issues in all kinds of different fields and disciplines. So we're not alone in that, which is not necessarily encouraging, but.
But in a way, it helps us find community.
Right.
Because, that, yeah, this right? is, I mean. This is happening across higher ed.
Silver lining.
We can complain together.
Exactly. Commiserate together.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. So you won't think that you're alone. Like, am I alone? No, you're not. You're not. They were tripping. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't you, it was them. Okay, it's them.
Exactly.
So this leads perfectly into our next question. How do you promote equitable practices through your work in the library?
Ooh, it's because I'm the boss. I'm a HIFA. So I am a department head, essentially. It's not in my title, but I get to, in some ways, do what I want. And I think also because I became a manager or supervisor during the pandemic, like I was moved into this position in May of 2020. And so there, that accompanied with the fact that I've experienced a lot of loss and grief has really impacted the way that I navigate being a supervisor, but also navigate my job. So there are a couple of things that I do mainly around the whole, you know, everybody likes to be treated in their own way. I've very much discarded that whole treat everybody how you want to be treated thing, because that's not applicable. And so I have every 6 months, I check in with my staff on how often they want to meet. That has shifted to between like biweekly or weekly or even monthly. Obviously, that I take other things into consideration with that request, but I do go with what they need from me. That may be, again, like biweekly meetings or monthly meetings. It depends on them. I also very much, our institution during quarantine, I'm just going to call that time quarantine. We're all stuck in our houses for like a year. But during quarantine, they implemented Wellness Wednesdays, so no meetings on Wednesday afternoons. And they really supported people going out for walks, like on the clock, like, you know, actually trying to take care of your mental health. And though the university has kind of forgotten about that, I still implement that. And I'm still very mindful of my staff schedules. I still very much encourage people taking mental health breaks. And I try to model that myself. And I still don't know if some of the things I'm doing are right. I don't know if that is the right word, but I am also very, some people would say vulnerable with my staff. I'm very honest about how things impact me. And so I will often say, you know, hey guys, I am experiencing a lot of stress due to this thing that is happening. Or sometimes I'll just say, I'm really overwhelmed. And I may not be responsive to your messages during this period. Like, thank you for your understanding. I also do struggle with this because as a faculty member, I have certain privileges that they don't have. So I am able to take what's called in our institution short-term leave. So I can take, which I don't know if that documentation is right, up to 12 weeks of leave to do specifically just research. It has to be approved by your supervisor and a bunch of people, and you have to propose it. It's a process, but I have this option that I've never exercised before. And so right now I'm trying to take advantage of it because I'm not only, because as you know, we have like four jobs as a faculty member. We have our service, and right now I'm vice president of the Reform of Colorado chapter. And then we have research, and I just got two works accepted. So I'm trying to work on those. And then not my supervision, which right now we just finished goal setting again, trying to be as equitable as possible, making realistic goals, keeping people's, not just their own goals in mind, but making sure that they have what they need to meet for merit so that they can get that money. Cause we don't get paid enough. They certainly don't get paid enough. And that fourth job is actually my librarianship, which is actually being the digital collections librarian and working on our digital assets and repository and workflows and, you know, that kind of thing. And so I feel like being transparent is a big part of those equitable practices, and also really just trying to work with my staff so that we both, as like collectively as a team, but also between just me and my staff, understand that this is just a job and that you are like what matters as a person. We've all been through so much in the past 3 years that it's affected all of us in ways that we can and can't see. And so I just really want to try to honor that. And even when it comes to new people, whenever we hire someone new, I always invite them out to lunch, and I pay for that lunch as a way to try to get to know them. I do try to build a lot of community, which at some points can be exhausting because I'm an introvert and, you know, I love people, but at the same time, I just want to be alone in my room and reading a book. So it's always trying to balance all of those things. But yeah, I do my best. And even when it comes to, and some of my friends know this, and it's probably maybe a bad thing, but like even, and maybe, I don't know. I'm just like, I just really want you to know that I value your time. So a lot of times too, like if I'm taking up a friend's time, I'll send them like a Starbucks gift card. Cause I'm like, listen, I appreciate your time. And I just like, I don't know, I want to send you something. And like, I'm really like, I don't know. I value people's time, and I try to make sure that I tell them that I value their time in different ways, whether it's with a gift card or like in like telling them I love you. Like I tell my friends I love them a lot. And it's interesting because this kind of goes into the grief and the loss thing, because there are often times when in libraries, especially, things can get very either harmful or like you're experiencing something that's not pleasant. And so I try my best to tell people, and I mean, and my staff is very different because I'm not telling them that I love them. I don't believe in that whole we are family thing. Like, no, they have their own lives. This is not a family thing. But I do in my own way say like, hey, I know that was really hard for you. So like, please feel free to take time before you get back to work, like wink, wink, like, you know, and maybe I shouldn't be saying that, but I really don't care because that actually makes everyone just happier, better, and, you know, whatever, productivity, it doesn't really, we're just trying to work together to accomplish a thing. And so I will support them in whatever way. And even with my colleagues who I know are also going through stuff, my like my other library faculty, my friends, really, but I also tell them I love them every day because I have been in that moment where one day you have a loved one who is here and then the next day they're not here. And so I also think about like, what would I be leaving if I just ended something without saying anything? And that can also be exhausting because obviously in the past 3 years, like 50 billion different traumatic things have happened. And every time I've had to send an email saying, hey, staff, I know today can be a really rough day. Please take all the time you need. Or like, here are some resources. And you can only do so much before it just starts feeling empty and hollow. And so, yeah, I'm struggling with equity, to be honest. I do my best, and I hope that my best is enough.
Well, I'll give you an A. I had to give you a grade. Because at least you're thinking and at least you're like implementing things and not just like, oh, I wish I could, you know, just like have all this theory but no practice behind it. So, and the good thing from what I'm hearing you say is that you assess, you know, like, is this working? If not, then I need to adjust to the needs of my staff, which is a great sign of a leader, in my opinion, you know. And I might be biased because I know you, so, but I don't know, who cares?
Well, I think that when you said that you tell, you know, employees to take time, you know, time off at the end of work stuff or whatever it is, however that is needed or necessary, I think that is also a marker of a great manager, to encourage that, because a lot of managers don't, right? A lot of people want you to just work until you have nothing left, right? But to encourage people to take time for themselves is, you know, one of the, I think, the greatest things you can do. So, I know I'm appreciative of that, and I've had that from my supervisors as well. So I definitely appreciate that, especially having had supervisors that don't do that. And there's definitely a difference, not just that, but in other ways as well, right? So yeah, I think that right there is a lot, is saying a lot. So we're gonna kind of switch streams a little bit. Early in your career, you became a member of the editorial board for In the Library with a Lead Pipe. Why was it important for you to contribute to the journal in this way? And how did it impact you as an early career librarian?
Oh, it impacted me a lot. I think it really helped me become the like researcher and scholar that I am today. And I'm always so grateful to the Lead Pipe team, because they were, I mean, I wish all libraries functioned like that, like actually functioned. I just remember meeting them at one of the ACRL's conferences to talk about it. And yeah, like they've just been, and first of all, like In the Library with the Lead Pipe is such a great journal. It's open access. It really, the best article, in my opinion, the best articles tend to come from In the Library with the Lead Pipe. And they really publish pretty progressive, like out of the box articles that every time I read it, I'm just like, yes, I feel seen. Like, not just seen, but like, this is the kind of work that I hope to do one day. And when they reached out to me to talk to me about potentially being on the board, I was flabbergasted. I was like, I'm a nobody. Like, I don't know why you're talking to me. But I appreciated it. And I definitely tried to silence that little voice in me that said that I couldn't do it, because I was just an MLIS student at the time. And I was working with, like, Ian has been on the board for so long. Like, there were so many people that I looked up to on the board, that I still look up to on the board, who I admire still to this day. And I felt like, much like your podcast, much like Live Voices, I really feel that open scholarship is so much more impactful than if it was like in a closed journal. Like, and now I'm forgetting the word, but basically like a paywall, right? And the fact that it is so accessible is what drew me to it. And then when I finally really got to do my own editorial work, I was like, oh my gosh. And all the things that I was working on, all the articles that I was working on, and the authors, they were just so excited and so open to feedback. And like, I'm just so grateful that it was something I could experience, because I got to see firsthand how the cookie gets made. I don't know. I love cookies, so that's a first thought.
Me too, yes.
But but I got to see how it, you know, how it all happened, how open peer reviewed happened, how you solicited peer reviewers and deadlines and timelines. And it just, for an early career librarian, it really has helped me in my own work understand the other side. Because now I've been on both sides. I've been, you know, a writer, like a author, and I've been an editor and a peer reviewer. And it was definitely one of the highlights of my career, I guess. I really, really enjoyed my time there. And while I was there, I got to work with Kelly and Ian on revising our policy around asking authors for their positionality, which I just loved everything about it. Cause we would run meetings and it was like, everybody understood their role. Nobody was like, it was easy. We would just take turns running meetings, and we would just have a list, and we would just go through, like, it was just, everybody knew what to do. And we had just a running Google Doc of minutes, like super basic, but it was easy. And during those meetings, we would just say, hey, what if we did this? And we would talk about it, and then we would do it. And like, I wish all meetings ran that way. I feel like academia has so much bureaucracy that it, like, being in Leadpipe was such a refreshing moment, because I didn't have to go through all those things. We would do it. And so we revise our positionality statements, or our requirements for asking for positionality, because we felt that that was needed. We had a lot of authors who, I think, again, this kind of goes back to my earlier comment, where I feel like white people are really not reflecting on their own identities around, especially when it comes to the scholarship and the work that they write and work that they do. So yeah, it was important for me to contribute, because I was able to help make these decisions. And to, I mean, I was able to, for example, write a first one, I think it's the only, I'm not sure, Spanish. We had an abstract that I translated into Spanish. So it had both an Spanish and English abstract, and really just get to contribute on different policies for the board that I felt were incredibly significant. And one of the few ways that I think Leadpipe is different from other journals, because I'm not sure at this point, I mean, I haven't done any research, but I'm not sure if any other library journals ask for positionality statements. I'm sure they do, but I can't remember. But yeah, and it just impacted my my whole research trajectory. I just learned so much from every single person that I was fortunate enough to work with. And like, thank you guys so much for everything.
I was gonna say that was great, especially, you know, just the, I mean, you get a sense of gratitude from you and the time mm-hmm. that you spent there, which is I think an amazing thing to have that, you know, not only were you contributing to the work of that journal, but you also got something from that, you know, from that service. And that's the best kind of service, right? Where it's a mutual kind of thing. And it's, you know, like a tangible thing, not necessarily, we're not talking about money necessarily, but just like this mutual beneficial kind of situation where you're able to give and receive from, you know, this journal or wherever you're doing service at.
So this question is going to pivot another way again. So we're going on a journey here. So thinking back on your time as a residency librarian and even in your current position today, what, if any, issues arose during that time? And have you experienced any obstacles to your success as an emerging information professional?
Evil laugh. Oh, no. residencies. I mean, residencies. I think they are not great. So I was DU's first residency librarian. I was the guinea pig, and that my experience was that, like, how it sounds, like I think they had an idea, but they didn't know how to execute it. I mean, and I have written a chapter about this. There were some really good points about my residency. I think the fact that they didn't know how to really rotate me between three departments impacted a lot, because so at DU we have quarter system, and I was like, what's a quarter system? So it's just 10 weeks. It's very fast. It's not like a semester, and it's very different, so much so that I was supposed to do a quarter in three different departments, but I ended up staying in reference for a whole year, which actually wasn't bad. But that, I think a lot of issues arose during that time, because in my experience, reference librarians tend to have very territorial, like, I guess, tendencies or feelings. And so it's very difficult for me to get experience on what a liaison really does. Not just that, but also because they all do a million things, collections, teachings, research. Like, I mean, everyone is busy, but I really wish that the library at the time, and still, because it still doesn't really have buy-in from people to help support a residency librarian. That is something that I hope we're working on. But that really led to me moving away from reference, because I felt that it wasn't as collaborative as it claimed to be. And so I moved back to kind of a more technical role. And I far more prefer it, because I do feel people in technical services, in my experience, where I am now, are much more collaborative than where I was before. And this is not to say that people didn't offer to collaborate with me. They did, but it was mostly other early career librarians. So it was more peer mentoring. And I just wish sincerely that, because I was so excited. I remember reading a specific article, which I'm not going to name I'm really not trying to pick on any one person. But it's more of a culture issue, in my opinion, than an individual, although obviously the individual contributes to the culture. But it felt like, really, I was so excited to learn from these people. And then when it came time to actually meet them after the interview and try to connect with them, I don't feel like I was seen even as human. Like I would try to build relationships with them, and I would do committee work just so that I could get their attention or we could have something to talk about. And it just, the connection wasn't there. And I would often get the excuse of like, well, this person's just really introverted, or they're really anxious, or they're really insecure about their own work. And I was like, well, that's me though. I'm also really insecure about my own work as an early career librarian. Like I'm also anxious and introverted and those things, but I'm here to learn. So I don't understand what the difference is. Like, why am I, you know, I just kept asking questions that I did not get sufficient answers to. And I really wish that had changed. We actually just got last year we hired 2 new residency librarians, totally different structure to help combat some of the issues from before. And I hope that they're doing better, but I'm not sure that they're getting the same support, especially since at this moment in time, we have 9 vacancies, which is like half of our faculty.
Yikes.
Definitely yikes. Big yikes. It's a big yikes. It's a combination of a lot of things, but yeah, I think my biggest obstacles to success is really just that lack of collaboration and lack of people getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. I think they're, which going back to like vocational awe and this, or maybe I'm pretty sure it's vocational awe. I should have read that article, but like before I've read it before, but I should have read it again. But there's this idea that people need to know the answers to everything. And I think librarians very much, especially the more experienced librarians, at least that I've encountered in my institution, right? Context, are very nervous about not having all the answers. And what I have tried to say in spaces where they could hear this is that it's not about having the right answers. It's about us working together to figure out the answers. And I really think that lack of collaboration or willingness even to collaborate, to even have those discussions, have really impacted our ability to move forward in our organization and in my career, because frankly, there were a lot of things that I wanted to learn from people who have been here for 30 plus years, 20 plus years, that now that they're retiring, I can no longer learn. And I think it's just a shame, because I really, as an early career librarian, I genuinely came into this job being super excited to learn from other people, and that didn't happen. And I honestly was a lot crushed. Like I was like that little puppy who's like wanting attention and like so excited, but then like, no, nobody, I don't know. Nobody did anything, and I had to figure it out myself, and I was alone for a very long time, and that 100% impacted my mental health, which again is an obstacle to my success, because for a long time I had to kind of figure it out by myself, and I developed a lot of not just imposter syndrome, but like a lot of things that I'm not realizing until now when I actually have 2 women of color to talk to, because now I have 2 women who I'm like, wait, that sounded really like racist, right? Like that sounded really not good. And they're like, yeah, no, you need to tell somebody about that. And I'm like, yeah, I do. And I do. Cause I used to second guess myself so much, but I think my residency had both pros and cons. And at least the one thing that I am grateful for is that when I did, because I told everybody everything, listen, my dean knows it all. Everything that I've said in the public, I've said to his face. So I'm like, even this now, like he knows. My supervisor and my dean both know all the things. I have absolutely no hesitation in emailing them about stuff that happens to me. So they know. And I do appreciate that they're not like, what's that word? Aggressive. They don't deny it. It will, to some degree, but they don't get aggressive about it. They don't get like mad or defensive. They, most of the time, they at least listen and they don't hold it against me, and they do try, which I honestly feel like is most days a low bar, because they should take more action. But I am grateful that I can speak my mind and they will listen.
Well, that's good that they listen to you and aren't dismissive of your experience. Because oftentimes that is the reality of a lot of people, is they finally get the courage to speak up and they're like, are you sure that's what, like you were talking about earlier, you know, are you sure? Well, they're an introvert, or, you know, they're insecure. And you're like, I'm the same way. But I put all that aside, okay, and try to be a collaborative colleague. Like, hello? Like, majority of us are introverts. It's something else there, but we know what that is, you know. But it's fine. I'm a shine regardless of your help or not. So it's unfortunate that you had to experience that, especially with reference librarians. I didn't realize how some of them are so territorial until one of my positions. So I definitely can relate to your experience, and I'm sorry that you had to deal with that nonsense. Because it, you know, when you collaborate as a reference librarian, it's better. And I feel like tech services, for the most part, you have no choice but to collaborate, because then stuff is gonna fall apart. And they're going to be asking, exactly, like, why aren't the links working? Mm-hmm. Why don't we know what's going on? You know, so y'all got to get out your little silos and come together, you know, so you have no choice. So, yeah.
Forced collaboration.
Forced collaboration, okay? But it collaboration nevertheless.
Right. I think that kind of that territorialness, too, is something that you can come across in other areas also, you know, in addition to reference, which is an unfortunate thing to have to experience, especially when you're, and I think this is when it happens the most, right? Or when it's the most pronounced, is when you're an early career librarian coming into a place where you have these like veteran librarians, and then it's like, what you feel or think or your ideas can be discounted as a result of that, you know, dichotomy. But it sounds to me like you've been able to navigate it, you know, pretty well. And then and you also know now what to do yourself as a manager to help others, you know, who are coming up, and so they don't experience the same things that you experienced. But it's also encouraging also to hear that you have supervisors who are, you know, willing to listen, who actually do listen, and I hope take action as a result of listening. Right.
I feel like I hope so. They take action, but I because some of them are personnel issues, I'm never sure what that action is, or if it has any impact, right? Because like I've been through two HR, like I've filed two complaints. I'm just gonna say that I filed two complaints, and both of them have resulted in essentially a waste of time. So it's like people try and do things, but it's only to the extent that, you know, what that person does. And that's why I wish that there was some way to hold faculty more accountable to their commitment to like equity and inclusion and collaboration. Because faculty, I mean, at least at my institution, like we're not really asked that in our annual reviews. Like there's no line for, have you been a good colleague? How have you demonstrated your commitment to EDI this year? Like, that's not a question that's asked in our annual reviews. So I really wish, I mean, I hope that in the future that becomes accountable in some way, but yeah, that's one of the challenges and actually one of my research interests, but yeah.
That's interesting. I know I've had a conversation recently with some colleagues at my job where we were talking about how to, you know, kind of model from the bottom up of what we would like to see in annual reviews and an emphasis on, you know, inclusion and equity and that kind of thing. And so the conversation was really like, how can we model that in our own reviews? And then maybe that's something that we can push upward, right? Of course, that's an uphill battle, doing it from the bottom up and as opposed to top down. So, you know, I don't really have an answer when it comes to that, but just to say that I think other people are also thinking about that. And I think, you know, if that's a research interest, that's definitely needed, because I'm sure that many of us see the need for annual review, you know, questions and things that are being emphasized to be changed, you know, and really reflect what our value should be.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest issues that I have with my library, actually, is that we don't, in my opinion, we don't live our values. And we are working on it right now, actively, as we hire these 9 people. And so, wish us luck. I wonder what things will look like in a year.
Time will tell. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us and talking with us about all of these things. We really enjoyed the time and just hearing you, your thoughts and ideas on some of these things. And you have a lot of different experiences, and it's great to hear you share about those things.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And yeah, you're definitely one of the people I admire from afar. So I appreciate you giving us your time today. Thank you.
What? I admire both of you from afar. Actually, Jamila, I have one of your YouTube videos bookmarked to add to my LibGuide.
Really? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I think it was like an ACRL presentation. That they recorded. Like, I have a bunch. I admire you both, honestly. And thank you so much for creating Lib Voices. It's helped me. I mean, honestly, even that comment, like, about feeling like the only one, it really helped me feel like, okay, this is not just me experiencing all of this. You know, every time I listen to an episode, I'm like, yes, like, Nikki, yes, I know exactly what you're saying. Preach.
Right.
Right. Yes.
So, thank you so
That's
much
how
for
we
this.
Feel every time.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, I could resonate with that. Oof. Uh-huh.
Well, thank you for that feedback. Also, it's always nice to hear, you know, from the people who are listening, you know, how they really feel about the podcast. So thank you for sharing that.
We hope you learned more about Denise Solis. We'd like to share a quote with you before we sign off.
I am my own muse. I am the subject I know best, the subject I want to better. Frida Kahlo.
Remember to keep walking in your Lib Voices, and please follow us on all of our social media pages.